All right, welcome to Boundless and Bottomless Seas.
What's up, everybody?
Nothing much. We're on Chapter 5, Global Transition and Its Enemies. But before that, I wanted to address a few things that have come up. One, I feel like the rise and fall of left Duganism has happened since we kind of started this series.
Yeah, I think so.
Weirdly, it's one of those things where their success made them rudely unpopular. By that, I mean the American Communist Party absconding with maybe, depending on who you ask, some chapters of the CPUSA, consolidating Midwestern Marx, which had to eat a lot of its own positions to do this, and Hinkle and Haas into one very massive media operation that may or may not be an actual party. Seems to have actually turned most of the MLs against any lingering Duganism, and they've become much more suspicious of it than before. I know a lot of people who were very friendly to Midwestern Marx who are now freaked out by this stuff. So I find that interesting in and of itself, that maybe by the time we started this, this has already lived through its second life cycle as an attempt to convert the left, and in real and people actually reading this shit, they're realizing what it is. But I also want to talk a little bit about some other stuff that's been brought up in the comments before we get into this. I've been mildly chastised for not going into the fact that Dugin is not just an Orthodox Christian, but a perennialist, and thus a radical traditionalist more. And that is because Dugin himself equivocates on whether or not he is still any form of radical traditionalist outside of Eastern Orthodoxy. And I have a hard time taking any of the claims that helps you read him seriously. Not that I don't think it's true, but that I've read many Dugin books at this point, like most of the ones available in English, and his books are radically different from book to book, just like his speeches are different from talk to talk. Like, he doesn't.
Yeah, I have to say, like, I don't think that would change anything for me reading this. Mm-hmm. Like, not like a secret filter that makes things make more sense or less sense.
Would it be a pointless sidebar for you to define what perennialism is?
No, I can go into it. Perennialism is a theory that all religions ultimately are syncretically recognizing the truth of a perennial religion, which is either a religion nobody is a part of, or depending on what kind of traditionalist you are, your already existing religion.
Okay. It's so, kind of what Hegel's position it was.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a Catholic perennialist, for example, which Hegel was not, but if you're a Catholic perennialist, you would say that, like, Hinduism still recognizes certain Christian truths because it's part of the truth of reality itself. But perennialism is assumed in Evola and Guénon, and in those weird mystical satanic things that Dugin was part of in his 20s and 30s. Maybe even his 40s, but he is supposedly, you know, even by the time of writing this book, become a good Orthodox Christian. Okay. I have pointed out that, well, only kind of can he be considered a good Orthodox Christian because some of the stuff is heretical. And I think people who want to correct me on the perennialism would have to deal with the fact that perennialism would be heretical in some form. Now, I would say there are Eastern Orthodox versions of, like, the cosmic Christ that would say, like, oh yeah, like, there's recognitions of the truth of Christianity by accident in all these fallen heathen religions like Buddhism and Hinduism. But I don't think that's exactly what's going on here, because the perennialism would be the justification for why, for example, he doesn't have a problem with Islamism. Hmm.
There's a slight version of that perennialism, which is ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. And it's only, like, officially not perennialist because of the influence of the Americanization of the post-industrial Protestant Second Reformation, whatever. Mm-hmm. I think if you were perennialist, but you didn't really talk about it very much, you didn't really, like, define it too much, you would not be heretical in most sects of Christianity. Mm. But in some, especially the more rigid you are about how true that makes other religions, you might be a heretic for sure.
Mm. Yes, it's up to the patriarch, right?
I would say, honestly, perennialism is an impulse that most Christian religions have because they actually claim that some of Christianity is rationally deductible, not just from revelation. Mm. So, right. So that they would say anybody who's spiritually seeking, even if they've never seen the light of Christ, could arrive to it. The problem that you have, though, is how far are you going to take that?
Well, right. That's the only actual question, but it's a big one.
Like, if you're a Vola, what you're trying to do is, like, find the true Proto-Indo-European Ubermensch religion.
Mm.
That, you know, is probably pagan. If you're Guanong, your first is like traditional Catholicism, but he ends up like tying Hinduism and Islam together. Mm. And Guanon is more, and I'm French speakers, you know, I'm going to butcher every name you guys have. is less political than Evola, even less political than Spengler, which it's closer to, but it is still thoroughly anti-modern. The other correction was that, you know, people were saying we were taking Dugin's stuff on race too seriously, that he meant it as a metaphor, and to which I say, well, he could have just said it was a metaphor then.
Sure. Yeah. He hedges a lot in this book. He could have hedged on that. He hedged on fascism. He could have hedged on race.
My criticism, my overall criticism so far, is that in general, Dugin operates like as though he doesn't need to clarify anything. I think maybe you guys both made this point before, but he was trying to keep things open to... I think, Varn, you said it was to throw everything at everybody and just see what sticks.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in every chapter so far, basically every single concept, he could have defined it a little bit more and saved us a lot of trouble.
Right. Well, and I think he deliberately doesn't. Like, yeah. I think that's, I mean, I can't prove it, but I do feel like that's tactical. And I don't just feel like it that way off of this book. I feel like it's tactical after reading a ton of his stuff and realizing how contradictory they are. Like, I can't square stuff in other books necessarily with stuff in this one.
One thing that we can give him credit for and being honest about is, I think, a tendency that's probably recognizable to all three of us and many people too, which, as a political philosopher, say what you want about the guy, his sort of ecumenical tastes and eclecticism seems to me to be this drive that he has to actually make like a new future possible, to like be doing politics, to create some sort of social basis for his political philosophy. And with that, casting a wide net seems to me to be an attempt to try to actually create a politics out of it.
Right. But it's a political myth. It's not a political analysis. Like, and I think this needs to be really dealt with, because you and I have talked about, well, he talks about liberalism as if liberalism does stuff, and we like can be really, really, really chastising and pretend like we don't know that he understands that, not that liberalism exists as an aggregor that does stuff. Although sometimes he does seem to talk that way, quite frankly. But in general, we could steel man it and say, well, he's talking about the habitats that liberalism creates. But he removes all that from political economy, and he does so and he does so not just on point of like avoiding it. It's actually a philosophical point for him that this is not based on political economy, that this is a larger source of meaning, and we're not really going to worry about that kind of stuff, which I guess
it kind of makes sense if you're trying to make a case that being itself, that Dasein is a part of, like, that is an agent, that is a subject. Mm-hmm. And I guess it kind of makes sense you would also talk about the being under a system, and the way that liberalism is being, the way that fascism is being. That kind of makes sense to some degree, but I don't think it's not clarifying.
Well, it's interesting to me that he doesn't actually do that much with postmodernism, even though he uses it, because he's basically operating under like similar terminology. And I think it's important to point out that the Heideggerian assumptions that Dugin has were not uncommon, and in some places are still not uncommon on elements of the left, not just on the Lacanian Althusserian left. Sorry, guys. There's all kinds of Heidegger that comes in through both Sartre and Kojève into Althusser, but also, and through Lacan in particular, but also in the like Agamben, Nancy, post-socialism of Barbary, that stuff is also full of Heidegger. And I'm not saying that like Heidegger's like Nazi particles, it's just going to turn you evil. But I'm saying that like there's a reason why 10, 15 years ago, this probably would have not read that differently from a lot of stuff you read if you were reading continental left philosophy.
Mm-hmm. New school shit.
Yeah. So I think you know, we are kind of past that, although I'll be quite honest with you, all the Deleuzeites and the Fisherites are not actually past that. Sorry, Mark Fisher fan.
No, I was going to say, I don't think we're as past that as maybe we think we are.
Right. We might be returning to it as in the farce of a farce of a farce of history continues, where we see, instead of the DNC, which is going on as we speak right now, mm-hmm. going the way of 1968 DNC, that like actually the protests are totally fucking up. Mm-hmm. They're not, and I don't mean in fucking up in the sense, oh, it's chaos like it was in 68. I mean, like they're not able to disrupt the functions of the DNC at all. They are ready for them. Mm-hmm. And it's actually making organizations like Frizzo look bad.
Mm-hmm. Making the Democratic Party look more unified than people had thought it might.
Right. And in fact, it looks like a good portion of the left is about to just liquidate itself into the Harris campaign, because that's what it really wanted to do anyway. And Joe Biden's senility was stopping them.
Right.
That's what, you know, that's where their true hearts lie. There's a lot of these radicalized people either want to be in meaningless sex or they want to be in the Democratic Party. So they
can Why not both?
Right. Or yeah, you could just kick it the old way and do both. And I think, you know, that doesn't seem relevant to this, but I think we have to ask ourselves, like, as we read this, why was this treated as so scary? I mean, you know, they did pull all these books from Amazon. You can still buy them in America. They're not banned in the formal sense, but like so many things, there did seem to be government pressure for Amazon to make it harder for you to procure them. And that only seemed to actually make it sexier and spread faster on both the right and the left.
Right. Definitely.
Whereas now that it's being more formally articulated in people who are no longer hiding the fact that they're Duganists, it's become a lot more unpalatable amongst people who were picking up. You know, there are all kinds of left-wingers talking about multipolarity in a Duganist way, not just in a general way.
Right.
Just 2 months ago, that are gone now.
Like, it was one thing. It was one thing to get it secondhand through like the gray zone or seeing news reports on Russia Today or whatever. It's another thing when it's a truly explicit political left tendency with it, with a program and with a membership and certainly with a media project.
Yeah. And one that keeps on weirdly finding itself in close proximity to actual Nazis.
Yeah.
And I don't say that to say that everyone in the ACP is a fascist. That's not my point. But the there is constantly, since the ACP has come out, you know, the ACP haters have been able to dig up where, oh, this guy is related to this actual third positionist group. This guy is related to these actual national Bolshevik groups. And it's been really discrediting.
As it should be.
Which is why I think we should, for people who wonder why I take an no platforming stance, even though I'm not often willing to have everybody and their mom on my show, is because I think a lot of times this stuff actually is a lot less sexy when you talk about it fucking openly. So
I think it's less sexy. It's also less dangerous. I think it's actually, it's just thought provoking and also not very useful otherwise. But if you present it as something dark and mysterious and it needs to be hidden away because it's dangerous, that makes it more attractive on the surface, but also it makes the concepts seem deeper and richer than they are.
In a real sense, this project that the three of us are doing, for me anyways, is a continuation of the Antifada project we did of reading Settlers, and not in the same way, because I don't, Jay Sakai isn't like Alexander Dugan, who are not relatable, but you know, there's a way in which the settlers discourse, settler colonial discourse, has reached a real head now and attempted to become an explicitly universalizing critique for obvious reasons over the last 10 or 11 months. And I feel like reading Settlers was really helpful, if only for a small inoculation, or if only for like trying to understand the actual heart of the of Sakai's debate there. Try to take it seriously, try to take his history seriously, and understand why it is that this sort of stuff is so compelling. Or in the case of Dugan now, repellent, as you said, with the ACP.